Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXI, Claudius Gothicus. The treacherous death of Gallienus saw the rise of a man of war. Claudius Gothicus definitely earned his title, and since he only reigned for 2 years, perhaps he had the right kind of impact without leaving too much of a bad impression. For an emperor in the 3rd century, that was more than enough, and he left an example for all who followed after. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
The Roman Empire is in a bit of disarray. The so-called Gallic Empire, that's a modern term, but there are separatist emperors ruling in Gaul, Britain, and Spain. And Gallienus, you know, before his death, was trying to take back those provinces. And then we also have issues in the east with Septimius Odenathus, who is controlling the east in the name of Gallienus, but he was also murdered as well, which created a power vacuum, which we'll be talking about in this run of episodes too.
So we are now at the point where there is currently a siege in which Ariolus has found himself out of his depth, I think is the best way to put this, declared for the Gallic Empire. Sounds like it was a bit out of desperation that he did that.
Yep.
And been left out to dry.
Mm.
But then Gallienus has been killed by his own troops.
That's right, yes. So there's been a conspiracy. The plotters include the Praetorian Prefect Aurelius Heraclianus, a cavalry commander, Lucius Domitius Aurelianus, who is the future Emperor Aurelian, and another commander, a tribune known as Marcus Aurelius Claudius, and he's going to be the next emperor.
So they conspired to kill Gallienus, and once Gallienus has died, they get rid of the patsy, the person who actually threw the spear in this case, wasn't it?
That's right. When Gallienus was going outside, you know, unarmed, yes, they got rid of the man who actually wielded the sword. Mm. This is one version. There is another much more positive version which glorifies Claudius and says that, you know, Gallienus gave him the purple on the deathbed. But this is probably a later invention because Claudius assumes a really important role in the family ideology of the Constantinian dynasty in the 4th century. So there's this tradition which completely exonerates him from the murder of Gallienus, which likely stems from the Constantinians.
Okay, so we've got all of that to wait in as well. So let's begin with, it's about September, October 268 CE at the moment, and we've got a new emperor, Claudius Gothicus. What do we know about the background of this person? And as you say, this comes with the disclaimer that a lot of his life has been rewritten by later Roman emperors.
Certainly, yes. Even then, we know quite little about him. So we know his name was Marcus Aurelius Claudius. We call him Claudius Gothicus because he wins a very famous victory against the Goths later in his reign. And we call him that to distinguish him from Claudius, the Julio-Claudian emperor of the 1st century CE.
But for the same sort of reason, I've heard him referred to as Claudius II.
Yes.
But that's a later kind of title.
Exactly, or yeah. Claudius II Gothicus, or something like that.
Yeah.
He himself did not have a regnal name in that sense. He's probably in his mid-50s, possibly from Illyricum in the modern Eastern Europe, modern-day sort of Croatia, Serbia, along the Danube. We're not quite sure, however, whether this was really true. There are lots of different versions. One version says he's a Dardanian from Troy, which could be confusion for the region of Dardania in Illyricum. So there's layers upon layers. And this is partly because the historian Augusta wants to invent backgrounds for all these emperors. And particularly if they're from a military background, there are stories about the great feats that they have achieved before emperors. We saw this in the case of Maximinus the Thracian, in inverted commas, you know, who was supposed to have appeared before the Severan emperors, for example.
I remember they talked him up as being almost, you know, a real
barbarian soldier's soldier.
Exactly.
But that's now a kind of a laudable trait for an emperor to have. How the times have changed.
Exactly, exactly. So now there's this change in the vision of what an emperor should be. Mm. So the Historia Augusta, the life of Claudius 13.6, talks about him wrestling on the Campus Martius in the reign of the Emperor Decius. So this is some 20 years before, so 249 to 251. And it says, "For, becoming angry at one fellow who grasped at his private parts instead of his belt, he dashed out all the man's teeth with one blow of his fist. This action won him favour for thus protecting decency. For the Emperor Decius, who was present when this was done, publicly praised his courage and modesty."
Decius was there at the time.
Apparently so, yes. Okay. Apparently so, yes. During that very slim moment that he was in Rome.
Oh, sorry, it's interesting that that's the point that I pick up about all of this. So this is going below the belt.
Definitely. He does it because, you know, this man, you know, tried to grab him. And so for that reason, you know, he punched out his teeth, did the right thing because that was a very immodest action by his opponent. It wasn't a gentlemanly thing to do. So we have almost like sort of English, you know, 19th century club rules being followed here.
Yeah, yeah. It's very strange that, you know, these are the qualities of an emperor, but sure, Historia Augusta. It does emphasize his more kind of traditional emperor qualities as well, though, doesn't it?
Definitely. So in the life of Claudius Gothicus 2.3, he says, and I quote, "The valour of Trajan, the righteousness of Antoninus, the self-restraint of Augustus, and the good qualities of all the great emperors, all these were his to such a degree that he did not merely take others as examples, but even if those others had never existed, he himself would have left an example to all who came after." So, you know, he's the epitome of both the military and the civilian qualities of emperorship there.
Okay.
And that's really important if we're going to link him to the Constantinian dynasty, because they are warriors, but they're also pious and just in their own image.
Okay, so he'll knock out the teeth of a horse with one punch, which is what it says elsewhere, sorry.
Yes.
But he'll write you a poem.
Yes. And, you know, will rule justly and, you know, he has a heart. He has a soft touch.
Sure. And he'll find your heart with one punch.
Yes. What we can say is he's a military officer. He holds the rank of tribune. He's of equestrian rank, so he's probably amongst this group of equestrians who have earned this status by working their way up through the army. And he also has a brother, Marcus Aurelius Claudius Quintilus, who is also an equestrian. He's been a procurator, so a financial official. Mm. So we're now seeing this real change after the assassination of Gallienus from senatorial emperors to emperors who have made their name working their way up through the ranks.
Okay, so what we can definitely say at this point, though, is that... And definitely, probably isn't a word that I should be using, but he was involved in the death of Gallienus, wasn't he?
I certainly believe that myself. I think the later tradition, the deathbed handing over of the empire is clearly a later invention. Mm. And there was so much mythologizing that surrounds Claudius, which we'll see in terms of his military career and his achievements and then his connection with the Constantinians.
So what is his first actions then as the Emperor of Rome?
So Aurelius Victor in the De Caesaribus on the Lives of the Caesars tell us that he was acclaimed emperor by the troops. And in chapter 34, he says the soldiers eagerly approved and praised the accession of Claudius, a man who could endure hard work, was just and totally dedicated to the state, so much so that after a long interval, he revived the tradition of the Decii. Now, the Decii are these father and son from the early days of the Republic who sacrificed themselves to save the state. There's also, of course, Trajan Decius and his son who rode into battle at the Battle of Abratus in 251. The reason Victor says this is that there is a prophecy in the Sibylline books which is revealed about this time that the foremost man in the state would have to sacrifice him to save Rome from a Gothic incursion. So there is a Gothic invasion. Claudius takes the field and he dies shortly afterwards. So there is this tradition that develops that, you know, he laid down his life. But we know he didn't actually die in battle. He died of the plague.
Okay.
So this is part of this subsequent mythologizing of his reign.
And is that Aurelius Victor just jumping to the end of the story there?
Yes, exactly. Well, because in the late 4th century, his readers would be expected to know what's happening. So, yes, sorry, spoiler alert there. I've just given away, the ending.
We're ending the episode early. Claudius Gothicus, he deifies his predecessor?
Yes, Gallienus is deified, which, you know, is a good move to do if you've been involved in plotting your predecessor, is to say he was wonderful and then move on. This caused great anger amongst the senators, who, of course, had to vote for the deification, because remember, at Gallienus's death, you know, his supporters were thrown headlong down the Gemonian steps at Rome, including his brother, Licinius Valerianus. But it's good, you know, in a time of turmoil to emphasize continuity with your predecessors. And this is clearly what Claudius is doing.
Yeah. So we've got this lover and a fighter now as the emperor, the man with all qualities that you could have and would want to have. And he's got a fractured empire under siege.
Mm.
So what does he do?
Well, he clearly has to be a military leader. That's his background. So the first thing is that he defeats Aureolus, who is in Milan. And in all probability, Aureolus is actually murdered by his own men, which again is another 3rd century pattern.
That was essentially ending the siege that killed Gallienus.
Exactly. So he's wrapping
up. Wait, I'm going into propaganda there. He's ending the siege that Gallienus died at.
yes, because of Claudius. That's right, yes. So, you know, he's tying up those loose ends. And then he has to go to Lake Bernacchus, which is Lake Garda now in North Italy. Lovely place to visit. But at that point, it was less pleasant because he was going there to defeat a force of Alemanni who had come down from the Rhine frontier. And because of this, he was proclaimed Germanicus Maximus, so the greatest conqueror of the Germans. And then he journeyed to Rome, and that's probably when he was officially ratified by the Senate at this time. There is one anecdote which is located in Rome during this period, and this is the story of a senior senator, Pomponius Bassus. So when the Sibylline books were consulted, because there were Goths, again, pressing on the Danubian frontier and the Eastern European provinces, they consulted the Sibylline books to find out what to do. And the Sibylline book says that a man had to sacrifice himself to save the state, to save the Roman Empire.
Mm.
And Pomponius Bassus offers to do this, but Claudius says, no, I myself will lead the army to the east.
That's biblical.
Yeah, again, it's probably completely false because why wouldn't Claudius Gothicus lead the army? It comes, you know, back to this idea that he's making some sort of special sacrifice of himself. But, you know, leading an army was what emperors did at this time. You know, if you weren't going to lead an army, then you weren't fit to become emperor.
Mm.
I personally don't believe the story.
Why is this a story that's come up then? Is the Sibylline books that important that they need to be followed still at this point?
No, I think it's because it's a story that paints Claudius in a heroic light. He reigns for a very short time, about 2 years, and this is one of the reasons why he's actually a very good ancestor for the Constantinian dynasty. You know, if you have a long reign, you know, there's a chance to do lots of terrible things that could give people offside. Mm. He reigns for a short time, wins a great victory, and then dies. So that is a really good ancestor to have if you're trying to connect yourself to a previous emperor, because other great leaders of the 3rd century, like Aurelian, for example, who we'll talk about later, were hated because of their cruelty and then their anger, even though Aurelian was, you know, very good at getting the job done.
Mm.
So they had to choose someone who was a great leader but didn't have a bad reputation.
Okay. He heads off then at the head of his army to sacrifice himself, which I'm saying a bit facetiously.
Of course.
So who is he going to confront? This is a Gothic invasion at this point.
Yes. So this is a Gothic invasion by sea. And here we depend on the account of Zosimus, a 6th century Greek writer living in the Byzantine period. But he is heavily relying on the 3rd century contemporary accounts of Dexippus, who we meet again and again as underlying these later versions. So the Goths had built 6,000 ships, which carried 320,000 men, we're told.
That's obscene.
Yeah. Well, again, with all ancient figures, we should probably take it with a grain of salt.
There's a multiplier there.
Yes, exactly. So they attacked cities of the Black Sea coast, so Tomis, where Ovid had been exiled, and then the Moesian town of Marcianopolis. And they repelled from both cities. So they then moved south to Byzantium, which is, of course, modern-day Istanbul, so a really crucial strategic location there on the Bosphorus. They failed to take Byzantium and then moved on to Thessalonica, which, of course, nowadays is in northern Greece. It's at this point that Claudius and his army appear on the scene, which leaves the Goths in a bit of a pickle. So they abandon the siege and instead move in to the interior of the Roman provinces, plundering as they go, again moving north basically to return and cross over the Danube. Because you remember that the Goths, their aim is not to capture cities and hold them, you know, to create their own sort of new empire. It's basically to plunder, to take gold, silver, and captives as slaves. We have another source which is very fragmentary, and this is a Greek source called the anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio. He's writing in Greek in the 3rd century, writing a history that picks up where Dio's left off, but we don't know his name, only survives in fragments. But it preserves some really interesting anecdotes about events that are taking place. So according to fragment 9.2, the Goths shouted abuses at the besieged inhabitants of these Moesian and Greek cities. They shouted, "These men do not live a human life, but a life of birds who have perched on high in barns." And, "Having abandoned the nurturing earth, they choose these barren cities." So these are jests, you know, saying, "Ha, ha, ha, you know, we're outside, you know, and you're holed up there inside, come out and fight like real men."
I assume that they'd be a lot more uncouth in real life.
Well, yes, yeah. They're very sophisticated. Very sophisticated illusions here.
Yeah, this seems like it's been cleaned up quite a lot by someone anonymous. So in this battle, this war that Claudius Gothicus is embarking on, we've got the next emperor with him as one of his key generals. This is Aurelian. And from what I could tell from the texts, he seems to get a lot of the credit, to the extent that I would say that the victory was down to Aurelian's mighty actions, depending on what sources you're going with, I suppose.
Yes, so he does definitely play a key role. So Aurelian, we think, is a cavalry commander. He's in charge of the Dalmatian cavalry. And certainly in the lead up to the great battle at Nisus in Serbia, he and his forces managed to kill 3,000 Goths. Now, the Romans do join battle, and they are led by Claudius Gothicus. And according to Zosimus, this is book 143, great numbers were slain in this battle in both sides, but the Romans, by a pretended flight, drew the barbarians into an ambush and killed more than 50,000 of them. So this is the great victory for which Claudius is remembered. He receives the title Gothicus Maximus, so greatest conqueror of the Goths. And because of this, the Goths spread out, you know, again raiding through the interior of the Roman provinces. But it's in this aftermath that there seems to have been some conflict between Claudius and Aurelian as to the military tactics.
All right.
The Goths are surrounded by the Romans at the Hymus mountain range in Thrace. And Claudius wants the infantry, which he commands, rather than Aurelian's cavalry, to engage. And the infantry does engage, but they are routed by the Goths, and so the cavalry has to come in under Aurelian to save the day. So this is the version of Zosimus, which depends on Dexippus, so, you know, from his 3rd century account of the Goths. It's interesting that other sources that glorify Claudius Gothicus from the 4th century, like Aurelius Victor, don't mention these events at all. Probably some of the subsequent whitewashing, because they don't want anything to interfere with the myth of Claudius.
They've won a significant battle, but it seems like they've created another problem, which is the spreading out of Goths into various raiding parties. They had a united force to fight against, but now they've got
a much more widespread problem?
Yes, because, you know, the Goths don't actually want to capture territory. They just want to raid. And so when they're raiding, you need to be able to pick them off. And obviously this is what the Romans failed to do, because at one of the key incidents, they were defeated because of disagreement amongst the commanders.
Okay, and how is this resolved?
Well, it's resolved by the hand of God in the sense that plague spreads throughout both armies. So this is still the plague of Cyprian, which has been raging now for some 20 years since the reign of Trajan Decius. And this is what Kyle Harper has characterized as a viral hemorrhagic fever. This decimates the Goths as well as the Romans, and Claudius himself falls victim to this and dies of the plague at Sirmium in September of 270. So he really doesn't sacrifice his life for the empire. He dies of the plague. He only reigns for 2 years, and because he's won this great victory, or you know, the great victory is attributed to him, the Senate deifies him immediately, and they vote to erect a golden statue of him in the precinct of the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline, and a golden image in the Senate House. So, you know, there is, you know, contemporary evidence of this very positive reception of this emperor. His later legacy is all due to the Constantinian dynasty. So, for a bit of a flash forward, we might be covering this in about 4 years' time, but the founder of the dynasty is Constantius I, who is a military officer from Illyricum, who then gets appointed Caesar and later Augustus as part of this system of the rule of four emperors called the Tetrarchy. And he's the father of the Emperor Constantine. And after Constantius dies, the Tetrarchy basically falls apart because of infighting between all the various members, and Constantine is one of those fighting for legitimacy. So in a panegyric, this is a speech of praise which is delivered to Constantine in 310, the orator makes an announcement to the gathered audience about Constantine's lineage. And I'll just read out, and this is from Latin panegyrics 6.2. "And so I shall begin with the divinity who is the origin of your family, of whom most people perhaps are still unaware, but whom those who love you know full well. For an ancestral relationship links you with the deified Claudius, who was the first to restore the discipline of the Roman Empire when it was disordered and in ruins, and destroyed on land and sea huge numbers of Goths who had burst forth from the straits of the Black Sea and the mouth of the Danube. Oh, that he had been a long-lived restorer of mankind, rather than too premature a companion of the gods." So this is this eulogy of Claudius and his achievements as the conqueror of the Goths.
You know, I can't really dispute that hugely in what it says as well. It's grand, but it's also very vague.
Mm.
What does it say that he does? He's, well, deified, okay. Restored discipline of the Roman Empire. So he didn't restore the Roman Empire.
I think it's to do with military discipline, you know. So Gallienus is hated by everyone. It's easy to rag on Gallienus in subsequent centuries.
Yeah, when it was disordered and ruined, and he destroyed on land and sea huge numbers of Goths. Check. That's all good. And
that's
then
all true.
His candle blew out long before the legend ever did.
Yep, exactly.
And off we go. That's really good. But when you put that together with all the other evidence that we've got, it kind of paints a very rosy picture.
Yes, and particularly the fact that, you know, he refers to this as an ancestral relationship. He's very vague about the familial connection.
Yeah, true, yeah.
And in the Historia Augusta, you know, there's various stories about a daughter or brother's son that Constantius I and Constantine were descended from.
Yeah, I have seen attempts to kind of trace it, because it's 50 years. That's not a huge amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, it is, on the face of it, plausible there might have been some kind of relationship, but the way in which it sort of springs out of nowhere in 310, when there are different emperors fighting, essentially, for control of the empire in this imperial system which is falling apart, and all these emperors are essentially nobodies. They're men who have made their names by working their way up through the ranks of the army.
Yeah.
So Constantine's publicity team says, hello, we're better than the rest of you because actually our guy is descended from the great Claudius Gothicus. This is designed to give him that sort of leap up, that sort of step up in those sort of later propaganda wars. And, you know, coins are minted about Claudius Gothicus. Inscriptions feature the lineage as well. It really becomes a key story which is told during this period.
It's not the first time, it's not the last time that people will claim lineage back to previous emperors. I remember somebody trying to claim a Gordian at some point.
Oh, yes, there is one story that Claudius Gothicus is descended from the Gordians.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Okay. There you go. Okay, so the lineage goes back even further, doesn't
yes,
it? Okay,
yes, all right. Yes.
So that isn't the only instance, though, of something being inserted into the history of Claudius Gothicus, is it? Because we've also got this later legend of St. Valentine, his origin story being connected to this reign.
Claudius is linked with St. Valentine from the early medieval period. So there are two accounts of the martyrdom of Valentine, first from the 6th century and then the second version from the 8th century. And they feature Claudius being based at Rome. So the first tale refers to a priest, Valentinus, who is based in Rome, who cures the blindness of the daughter of a Roman official. And the official is so grateful to Valentinus that he and his household all ask to be baptized. So they all ask to convert to Christianity.
Yeah.
However, Claudius is so furious, because of course he's a pagan, he has the priest beaten and then beheaded on the Via Flaminia, which is the main route heading to the north of Rome, on the 14th of February. So a key date there. And then a woman named Sevilla takes up Valentinus's corpse and buries him at the site of his execution. The second version from the 8th century has Valentinus as the Bishop of Terni, a town in Umbria. Valentinus is summoned to Rome to help a student, and this is incredibly unbelievable story, a student whose head has been stuck between his knees for 3 years. The bishop cures the student and his father converts to Christianity. Valentinus is arrested by the Roman prefect, who orders him to sacrifice to the gods. The bishop refuses and is beheaded, and so his body is then buried outside Terni in Umbria. So that one is located in the reign of Claudius, even though he doesn't personally appear in that.
Okay. This just raises a lot of questions as to why is this connected to Claudius Gothicus? Just convenient?
It just convenient happens to be set during his reign.
Okay.
Yeah, because a lot of stories get associated with emperors who are known to be pagan. So, you know, you can situate things during their reigns as long as they're a pagan emperor.
Yeah.
It really doesn't tell us anything about Claudius's own intentions.
Okay, but this also ties in with the entire, you know, make a sacrifice to the pagan gods or we're going to execute you. That's all persecution of the Christians kind of behaviour, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it's complete. I mean, we don't know of any sort of state-sponsored persecution of Christians in this time. It's all very local initiatives. But what the Christians, you know, have said is, okay, this is the 3rd century. This is when we know emperors were persecuting us. So let's pick a name out of a hat.
Mm.
Valentine doesn't become associated with love before Chaucer. So it's a medieval invention because, you know, this is the time when, in the Northern Hemisphere, when spring is appearing and, you know, birds are mating and singing, and so Chaucer creates the idea of this as, you know, when love is blossoming between birds, and
yeah,
then it becomes in sort of medieval chivalric romances, it becomes, you know, the day for romance when you write poems to your beloved and things like that.
Next Roman emperor that we've got is Quintilius.
Mm.
So how does Quintilius become the emperor? Is he a general who is just the right person in the right place at the right time for a brief amount of time?
Yes, well, he's Claudius's brother, so he does have a connection there, and the Senate endorses him as the next emperor. We're not sure exactly who or what he is commanding. Some forces in Italy, they could be Praetorians perhaps. However, he only reigned for 17 days before dying, so he doesn't get a whole episode to himself.
No. But the fact that he's been appointed by the Senate is not a very common thing in the Roman Empire at this point.
Yeah, that is completely true. And it's probably because of the memory of Claudius. You know, he did such a good job. Rome always tries to prefer dynastic succession if it's available, and especially if he's on the scene in Italy, then he is a good candidate. However,
the army has chosen Aurelian.
Yes. Aurelian, often the Danube, has been chosen by the army. And we're not quite sure of the chronology, though. So he dies 17 days later at Aquileia. So this is in North Italy, a major staging post if you're going north or east from Italy. And there were lots of different stories. The historian Augustus says he was murdered because he was too stern and unbending towards the soldiers. Eutropius and the Epitome Caesaribus also have murder. Zosimus has this very interesting tale, and this is in Book 1, Chapter 47, that Quintilius receives the news that Aurelian has been proclaimed emperor by his own troops. And so Quintilius is advised by his friends to die by his own hand and give place voluntarily to a man of so much greater merit. They report that he complied by opening a vein and bleeding to death.
You know, if this story was 200 years earlier, I might buy that.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem right with this era of Rome.
No, he's not sacrificing himself simply because Aurelian's the better man for the job. I think it's because his troops revolted, or he knew that Aurelian was on the march and committed suicide. It's a very short reign.
Okay. So regardless, our next emperor is Aurelian.
Yes.
To kind of tell people what's going to be happening ahead, this is the man who's going to reunite the Roman Empire.
Yes, Aurelian, the restorer of the world, as he called himself.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, tell a friend, or leave a review on any welcome podcasting platform. You can follow the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we begin our look at the reign of the Emperor Aurelian. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.